Good morning, and welcome to Lopes on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes, and today I am joined by Connor.
Good morning, Joey.
Hey, Connor, how you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, it was a pretty eventful past couple of days. I gotta say that I'm really not loving all this pollen in the air. You know, I think that's what's really getting to me over the beginning of this sort of summer season. You know, I don't know if this is pollen season. Usually I expect that more in like April, at the beginning of spring, but man, my allergies have not been behaving the past couple of days. I don't know if it's the same for you. I would assume that it's probably pretty bad up there also.
Yeah, you know, it's not, which is good. There's not nearly as many trees up this way, so
that's
allergies
true.
Are
that's
much
true.
Worse in Delaware.
I guess I could understand that. But man, it's been you know, my eyes are getting all watery. You know, my nose is getting all stuffy. It's like all of the things that you don't want to happen are happening over the past couple of days. But
well, make sure you get yourself tested because it's going around again.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I'm fairly certain this is allergies though, just based on the it happens every year. You know, there's always a period that I gotta just suffer through this, and then next thing you know, we'll be okay, and the actual summer will start.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the good news about allergies is that, you know, just because you have allergies doesn't mean that you can't watch movies. You know, like it's still very, very much a doable thing, a beautiful thing, an incredible thing, and that's what we're here to talk about. Is you know, a movie that me and you both watched just the other day, actually. But I gotta give a disclaimer before we really get into this episode that I think this is going to be the most indulgent Lopes on Movies episode that there's ever been.
That's right. We're finally going to talk about Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of
Madness, I think.
Madness.
Things are going. He's mad. You know, he's angry. You won't like him when he's angry, that Doctor Strange, you know. I wonder what happens in that movie.
I don't know, but I know that. I don't even want to say anything because people are gonna get all upset that I'm like spoiling something.
That's true. Yeah, you can't say anything. Yeah, you got to be careful not to spoil Doctor Strange. But my point is, like, I can't think of like any movie further away from Doctor Strange than the movie that we're gonna talk about. Oh man. But you guys love us for this, right? You'll forgive us for these indulgent episodes about random movies on TCM from 1945. All right, I need to give some background on this because I don't want people to be completely confused. I've talked about on the show the past couple of weeks that I took a class, a film class with Professor Thomas Leach, who of course we've had on the show before. The class's subject was on femme fatales in movies and in a lot of novels as well, actually. So the
can you start off basic... just explain what is a femme fatale?
So like a femme fatale is a character type that you see in film noir, which again, like film, that's another thing I guess I should explain film noir a little bit. I think everybody kind of knows what film noir is just from like cultural osmosis, but like there's a little bit of received wisdom about it that's like kind of wrong that I always think is really fascinating. Like, for example, one thing that I always think that's so funny is like when I actually took a class on film noir specifically with Leach back in college as well. My kind of cultural impression of film noir was like, yeah, it's, you know, it's movies from, you know, like the 40s and 50s, but they're about detectives and they got this, you know, this moody jazz music, you know, and it's like they're in the city and it's all moody and dark and all that. And what you learn is that really like film noir is a lot more about like insurance company fraud and, detectives feature in some of them, not in all of them. And the music has nothing to do with jazz 99% of the time. If you want to call Anatomy of the Murder something that sort of builds off of the noir tradition a little bit, even though it's a little bit late for that, like that's like the only Hollywood movie with a legitimate jazz score from that era with the Duke Ellington music, and it's not anything like the moody, like kind of, you know, soulful trumpet music that you might think, or soulful saxophone music and the dark vibes. Like all of that is like came way later. Like there's a thing called neo-noir, which is sort of like the movies from way after the noir era that sort of built on some of the tropes of noir but were more like modernized or whatever, like movies like from the 80s or something, like Body Heat, or I think that the super classic one is Chinatown with, you know, Jack Nicholson and everything. And those movies definitely have that sort of moody jazz influenced music. But the actual movies of the noir era, which is more like, you know, 40s and 50s, are classic Hollywood movies. So their music is, for the most part, classic Hollywood scores. Nothing to do with jazz. Not at all. So I always thought that was really interesting, that it's a genre that's sort of, I guess, misremembered just because of all the tropes that people kind of associate with it that came way later. But it's I really love film noir. Like I love this period of Hollywood history. And it was great taking this class, because this class about femme fatales is about like a very particular character type in noir, which is basically a woman who is pure evil, leads a man to ruin, usually through seductive tactics. A classic example is something like Double Indemnity, where a woman basically seduces a insurance agent to help her kill her husband and then collect insurance money on it so that they can be together. But of course, after they do so, you know, everything goes south, including their relationship. And, you know, the man ends up thinking, you know, I never should have gotten involved with her, right? But she's basically pure evil. There's a lot of shades of this. And of course, that's what the class that we that I took was about, was all the different shades of femme fatales in noir. But that's sort of like the basic type. So that class was great because there was a lot of movies from this era. There was a lot of more modern examples as well, but a lot of movies from the 40s. And the interesting thing is that a lot of those movies were based on novels. They came from stories that were like kind of hard-boiled crime stories of the era, which the funniest thing is that I probably hadn't read a book for like 10 years, like a novel, before taking this class. And now like I can't get enough of these like 40s, like 30s suspense novels. And just, you know, they're so good. And the one novelist that I think is like sort of the prototypical like noir novelist that so many of these movies, I think, owe a tremendous debt to is James M. Cain. His first novel was The Postman Always Rings Twice, which was made into a movie many, many years later. And actually a more recent version from like, I think the 70s with Jack Nicholson was made also, which is very strange. We watched that in class. But he also wrote the novel of Double Indemnity is based on. It's called Double Indemnity. And yeah, so he was a tremendous writer of these kinds of like interesting, hard-boiled, dark stories. And like both Postman and Double Indemnity are basically about the same thing, about a man who like falls for a woman who is married to somebody and they plot to kill the husband. And so he definitely like that's like such a classic noir thing that we associate with this genre, that he basically invented that story. Well, I shouldn't say invented the story, because there's plenty of examples of that from like fiction for all of history, but at least in this era, he kind of popularized it, and that's what became such a big part of the movies of the era. But he continued writing novels after Double Indemnity and was a pretty celebrated American novelist. And one of those novels was Mildred Pierce, which is the movie that we watched, is based on that novel, Mildred Pierce. And actually, I think in Leach's graduate section for the class that I took, they also read Mildred Pierce and probably watched this movie, but I'm not entirely sure if they watched the movie. I know they read the book, but just because I really liked these Cain novels and was really interested in learning more about him, I decided, I'll read Mildred Pierce. Let's see what this is about. Surely, you know, it'll be interesting if James M. Cain wrote it. And man, was it very interesting indeed. I read it in like 2 days. Very, very compelling story. Basically about a woman in the Great Depression who she leaves her husband kicks her husband out of the house, and then she becomes the sole provider for her two daughters. And it follows the psychology of these characters and how she adapts to this situation throughout many, many years of her life. Like, it probably covers a period of around 10 years, just about. So yeah, it's a very, very compelling novel, and it was made into a movie in 1945 directed by Michael Curtiz, who of course is most well known for Casablanca at this point. So yeah, I don't know if you knew that this movie was directed by the guy who directed Casablanca.
I did actually. Yeah. I saw that. I was like, awesome. You can trace everything back in the old Hollywood, and it's like, like you can play that game where you can cross everything around, like who played in this and that and how their careers go. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And this is after Casablanca too. Like a few years later. I don't think many years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this movie stars Joan Crawford in the lead role as Mildred Pierce. I think this was like her career was on like a slight downturn from what I read when she did this movie, but this kind of like brought her back for a little bit for like a second wave of her career.
Well, that's because she got old. She had the problem of becoming an old lady in Hollywood at the age of like 40 or something.
That was we actually watched this movie on TCM, which was funny. It just happened to be playing like the day after I finished reading the book. So that's kind of why we decided to watch this. But yeah, that was the intro from Ben Mankiewicz.
What an intro he has and he gets. Like, it's like him like sitting there, like all looking into the sky, gazing, like thinking about the movies that he's watching. It's a great little intro just for him.
Yeah, I don't want to go on a huge tangent about TCM and Ben Mankiewicz, but at the same time, ever since I started watching TCM, I'm fascinated by like the way that the intros before the movies look, because they have like the camera on some kind of like it moves, right? The camera like kind of rotates around the subject who's talking, usually Ben Mankiewicz or one of the other hosts, and the host has to like the host is always facing the camera, but because the camera's moving, that means that the host has to constantly be like turning themselves to face the camera while it's rotating around them. So I'm always just like really conscious of this. It seems so strange. But that has nothing to do with the movie. But you know, if you ever watch a TCM intro, yeah, you'll pay attention to that. It's very, very unsettling. Anyway, Mildred Pierce. I'm really curious what you thought of this movie, Connor, because I watched this primarily out of curiosity, having read the book and knowing sort of some of the things that are different in the movie compared to the book. There's one very, very significant different thing. I don't know if you read about that, but definitely would be curious to hear your take on this.
I thought it was great. It's such an interesting story. I really like how these stories just are like they hold back no punches really of what they are, and like the mm-hmm. I mean, I guess we didn't even get into the part of how a lot of this is how Joan Crawford's character, who is Mildred Pierce, by the way. I guess, I mean, the name is just, we gotta update that name, you know, maybe make something that'll be a little more, you know, not as like old, so that people would like want to see this. That name is just, you know, it's just so old. But
it's very much of the time. You know, yeah, you read it in a name like that, you know this movie's from the 40s.
Yeah, it is. But I think it's one of these stories that's like that feels pretty timeless, you know. Like, this could happen in any era. Like, it's not so. I mean, I know it takes place, I guess, around like Depression era, but like, there's
certainly the novel does. I don't think the movie like ever is explicit about it.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't need to be really either, because it doesn't matter. Like, it's just the point is, you know, her husband is at the beginning is down on his luck and is out of work. And mm-hmm. it breaks up their relationship, and then meanwhile they're also dealing with raising their two daughters and seeing how they're kind of disagreeing with the way that they're kind of growing up, or the way that they're their behavior also. Mm-hmm. And I guess they're having, there's difficulty there right from the start of like how they're being raised and like the kind of like women they're growing into, really. Mm-hmm. And that causes like the strife, which is, I think, you know, very transferable to any time period. I don't think it matters at all. But yeah, so the interactions between Joan Crawford and all of the characters are just so good. And I'm like, there's also Jack Carson, who's probably the most interesting character for me, like, because he's just like this businessman type who like kind of helps her start her own business, really, but yeah, also yeah, is kind of yeah. like lusting after her too. But it, but
yeah,
weirdly,
that first scene also with him is so interesting.
Weirdly, also he's like not a bad guy, but then sometimes, but he also is like, but he's still looking out for like. Yeah. He's a very interesting character. I thought. I mean, really, mm-hmm. all the characters are very deep and interesting. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm curious at how the book would be. I'm sure the book would have more time to flesh these characters out more too. So mm-hmm. you probably even get more of that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and then obviously the interaction with Mildred and her daughter Vita are mm-hmm. Definitely just the best stuff, the most mind-bending, fascinating things.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so the funny thing is, like, when I first read about the movie, the impression that I got was that it was very different from the book. And so I should be clear, the most different thing about the movie compared to the book is that there's no murder in the book. So like the whole like crux of the movie stems from the right in the very first scene, you see a man get murdered and there's this sort of like question of who did it. And that's like I guess that's really the film noir element, this sort of like hard boiled, like, you know, investigating a crime element that was sort of injected into this story as opposed to something that was actually in the story from the start. But I actually feel like it's kind of a natural fit for the story. Like, it definitely, like, the book is different, but I was surprised by how much of the book's spirit was still in this based on, like, the impression that I was getting.
I'm, like, shocked I'm shocked that the murder is not in the book.
Yeah.
Because it just fits so well, because it also, it sets up all of, like, the story progressions well. Like, because you have, like, the detective, who's not a major character, but he's the kind of the one that's guiding you through everything that happens, like, to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
It fits well. Yeah. All right, keep going. I'm curious.
Yeah, yeah. So I was interested to see how the murder changed the story. And I think, like, it's definitely a different story, but at the same time, like, I definitely feel like a lot of the book spirit is still in it, especially with regards to Vita, who is such a compelling character. And I even felt like, in the novel, that, like, and this isn't exactly a spoiler, but like I feel like I had never read a more just inherently evil character than that character. Like you'd read these things and you were just like, could not believe what you were reading. But at the same time, there's such an interesting dynamic between her and her mother, because her mother is like, she's almost obsessed with her daughter in a way, where she wants these great things for her. She has so much like belief in her talent and ability, and so she's obsessed with making sure that she has everything that she could possibly want, regardless of how much she has to work for it. And the Vita, being spoiled and like sort of fancies herself like a socialite, has just resentment for her mother just for the fact that she works at all.
Yeah,
and that
yeah,
she's like, yeah. So she, this really, really toxic dynamic where Mildred will do anything for her and Vita will gladly accept anything she does while absolutely hating her guts the entire time. It's so evil. And yeah, like I feel like the novel even like takes it for, like you said, like the novel is definitely more psychologically deep, with all the characters, I think, but the movie definitely does a great job with capturing a lot of the spirit of it, for a movie. And it is a pretty long movie, actually. All things considered, like a lot of movies from this era aren't really like that close to 2 hours. But this definitely is a little bit longer because it has like a lot of stuff that it needs to get through. Something I learned like a little bit later was that there's apparently an HBO miniseries about Mildred Pierce that was directed by Todd Haynes, the filmmaker Todd Haynes, who basically took the book and adapted it almost one-to-one. Like to the point where like he had, like most of the dialogue or all of the dialogue practically in this miniseries comes directly from the book, and it follows the plot of the book way, way, way more strictly. So I watched the first episode of this, and it definitely follows the book way, way more. Yeah, it has like Kate Winslet in it, and I didn't get to the point with what's her name, Evan Rachel Wood, playing Vita.
Oh, Vita's not even in the first episode.
Well, so she's younger. Like the book, like I said, it follows a period of like 10 years. So she's like 11 when the book starts.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So I think the movie probably follows a time period that's more like 5 years or four
yeah,
years,
roughly
maybe?
a little bit shorter for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause she's like a teenager already.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you get to see more of her development in the book and I guess the show also younger, but I guess you can still see it there. But I'll tell you, it's such a great performance, but every character is so nuanced too, you know, like they're all these great gray characters that just have like so much going on. Like you feel like you can really try to understand them, the way they think too. Like, I don't know, is the dynamic between Mildred's first husband in the book. So Bert Pierce.
Yeah, yeah.
I found him to be really fascinating too in this, because he shows up recurring wise, and you're trying to understand how things like fell apart for them and like who, like why it happened too, and you kind of get you see it differently as the story kind of goes. Is that fleshed out like differently in the book? Is he still like a big character in?
Oh yeah, he's a very important character.
Because I feel like it would be cool to have more of him in the movie, but I guess you have to fill.
Yeah, it's tough. I feel like Bert was definitely the character in the movie that I felt got the biggest disservice. I didn't love the performance of the actor that played him personally.
He seemed a little stiff, but a little bit stiff. Yeah, like didn't have to be really. Because I thought that character had a lot more in there, because all the other actors in this like really were like, I don't know, so strong, just like I've seen like the different sides of them, and I mean it would have been nice to I'm reading the book or watching the series, I'm sure you get much more of Monty Barragán.
Oh yeah.
I feel like the one thing you don't see that much in the movie version is it's implied through certain things, like when they go to his beach house and stuff, and you see that he's got a bunch of like clothes from like his like women that work for him or something, and it's like, all right, well, that's a little weird, but that's like, it doesn't make you a bad guy or anything like that, but then you don't really see as much of the of how he's this kind of problem person potentially in the in the movie. I did you get that sense? I don't know, maybe I'm just like,
yeah, so I think it's just a case of like it's harder to flesh out those characters in the movie in the same way that the book can, but the movie I think does a good job at least hinting at it, like you said. The thing with Bert is that the main reason why Bert leaves her is because, like you said, he's down on his luck. He's in the book and in the movie, but more obviously in the book, he was a real estate guy who kind of lucked into property. Basically, he owned like a farm that they wanted to build on. So as a result of that, he just became, you know, wealthy and part of this partnership. But then sometime later, this falls apart and he's not making any money anymore. And just as sort of like in a period of weakness, you know, masculine weakness, he falls for this woman, Miss Biederhoff, where he's basically just having an affair, and that's the thing that leads to them splitting up. Primarily is just that he's like kind of running around and isn't doing anything, and she just kind of, you know, resents him for that. But then with Monty, his character is interesting because I feel like a big part of the novel is this just class divide, where Monty very clearly just comes for money. And he has no interest in working. He just kind of is there being somebody who's rich. But after a certain point, especially in the Depression, that doesn't really work anymore. So he's basically like loafing around selling stuff to stay afloat.
The movie does a good job showing he's got no chops either. Like, he has no way to, like, figure out how to keep himself rich either. Yeah, like, even, exactly. Like, there's a lot of rich people who can, like, make them, like he made the bad deal, really. Because the character that I think is fleshed out the most, other than Mildred Pierce or even Vita, is Wally. You know, the actor played by Jack Carson, who's, like, the guy who, like, helps her buy, get the restaurant and everything. Like, he's really fleshed out, and he's the one who made the deal, and, like, Monty just gets, like, totally, doesn't even think of it, like makes that horrible deal. Like, you know, a wiser person who's wealthy, you would think would be able to realize that, but he's just not, he's not there. Kind of like Vita, really, just, like, just a socialite type.
Yeah, just literally just somebody who's wealthy and kind of resents people who work just for the fact that they have money and don't have to work.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is great. And Joan Crawford's, like, probably the best part about it, too.
Oh, yeah, such a great performance.
She's just amazing in this. Just, like, it's such a wild performance of just, like, her sheer determination to, like, get everything through. And she actually accomplishes all of it, and her just... all the people around her who are just, like, so awful, really.
Yeah.
That are just there to, like, bring her down, and she just does everything to try to just, like, prop up her family, really. Mm-hmm. And specifically her daughters, really. But will sacrifice any of her own personal life or everything just for them, and then just, like, resented for it, which is, gosh, what a performance.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. Yeah, it's very, very compelling. She, you know, is a very well-deserved Oscar win for Joan Crawford. I think it's the only Oscar she won, actually, for a leading performance.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember Mank said that she didn't even show up because she thought that... who was going to win?
I think she thought Ingrid Bergman was going to win for something, so she didn't want to show up, lose, and then have to be, like, you know, smiling in her seat for the duration of the Oscars. But then she won, and, you know, she, like, faked having, like, the flu or something to not go, but then when she won, she, like, got all made up, and, you know, the photographers, like, photographed her in her bed with the Oscar or something. Oh, man.
that is a good story.
I love actors. Actors are hilarious.
They really are. It's always interesting. Yeah. You know, even back then, the Oscars were something.
Yes, they were. So
not quite like the Oscars we have now, but, you know. It's,
I feel like, you know, there's definitely a lot of crazy Oscar stories, but I feel like we're living in a beautiful time for crazy Oscar stories oh, man. Anyway, I think that's going to be it for us, everybody. So thank you for, you know, letting us indulge in this movie from 1945. We'll probably do it again, knowing us. So, yeah, check out Mildred Pierce. Why not? Why not? That's the big thing. Why not? Well, what's stopping you, you know? Like, it's old, it's in black and white. Why is that stopping? You don't
have to stop it. Or just watch any of these Netflix shows that are getting canceled after, like, their first season, and you'll never know what happens.
Exactly.
You know, those shows will only take you 10 hours to watch, and then you'll never actually get any, you know, conclusion.
No closure.
Yeah. The best way.
All right. We'll see you next week.